The armor of God is perhaps a sort of thing you don't think of too often. We don't have people walking around today with swords and shields and helmets. And if you do, chances are they're at a Renaissance festival or that sort of thing. And it takes a certain type of person, I hope I don't offend anybody, to really get into that Renaissance festival dress-up stuff. I got in trouble once at one. I was in a shop with a friend, and I made a goofy little comment that I think they put on these whole big fairs just so these people can dress in public the way they usually dress in their homes. And I got a few dirty looks, but, you know, and the same, I remember going to Gettysburg and seeing that there's people who spend their whole lives dressed up as if they're in Civil War. And they talk like that, and hey, how's my grandpappy? And, you know, whatever. And dressed up like they're in a war, but they're not really in one. And read recently a book by a pastor in India who grew up in India and then came to the United States, oddly enough, to learn English. And so, of course, they started him in seminary, which was Greek and Hebrew. Whatever. Anyway, served the church in America for a while and then went back to the United States. And he said one of his biggest impressions of the church in America was that it was like a church playing soldier without really being in a war. Like they talked about being persecuted. But, I mean, really, what's the worst persecution you get as a Christian in our country, you know? I've offered to pray for people and they go, ugh. That's the worst persecution I've experienced, right? In a little while, we're going to be, our worship team gets to lead an annual gathering of the churches of the network we're in, and it's churches in Wisconsin and churches in Germany and churches in Vietnam and Africa and even churches in Dimebox. But it'd be about 1,000 churches gathered together to worship and meet, and we get our little ragtag team gets to do the opening worship, and we invite you all to come along so somebody knows a couple songs. And but last time I was there, they invited some pastors up to take off their shirts. And you're like, what's going on here, right? You don't need to see that. And but the catch is, they were pastors who had been arrested and imprisoned and beaten for sharing their faith. And they got up on the stage and took off their shirts, and you could see all their scars. And you know, one, it gives us all a moment's pause to reflect on whatever we whine about and grumble about. But they weren't up there like pridefully, you know, like look at me and my strength. It was just joy at being able to know the Lord and his peace and his vindication and his power, even while they suffer for the Lord in chains. And we have this reading in Ephesians where Paul is actually also in prison and writes about the strength of the armor of God. And he has two points, and one is divine protection, and the other is a call to arms. There's divine protection, a promise that you are protected and your strength is not of your own. In ancient times, there was a different understanding of swords and shields and armor than we have today. There was a belief that the armor, the sword, the shield a soldier used was imbued with the power and strength and authority of its owner. So if you were using somebody else's sword, it wasn't just you were using a sword and it happened to belong to somebody else. It was the notion that this sword has the power of the master somehow in the very thing. Like if I got to, you know, play Jimi Hendrix electric guitar, right? Like there's something about something that was owned by a master that would give a novice a strength and a power And in the story of David and Goliath, we have that story where there's this little boy that's going to go and fight this huge Goliath, and he's just going to tear off his head and kick it around like a soccer ball or something. And the king is worried about him, and he offers his armor, right? He offers David, little David can put on the king's armor and go into the battle with the armor. And the understanding was that then he would go into battle with the king's power and authority. But the catch was, if David would have won the battle wearing the king's armor, the credit would not be given to David, and the credit would not be given to God. The credit would be given to the king. And David takes off the armor, steps out into the field, stuck in the middle of a valley between two hills, all by himself, but not by himself at all. Because he had full strength and faith and trust in God's protection for him, no matter what situation he was walking into. And so at the end of the day, all credit was given to God, with a good story told of David, instead of the power all being credited to the king. And verse 10 says, be strong in the Lord. Be strong in the Lord. Not in your own strength, but be strong in the Lord. So often we think we just need to do something better or grow stronger or be better, or do better. And the reminder is that we just need to be strong in the Lord. And the amazing thing about all this armor talk and this war talk is that our fight is not against people. Our fight is not against some people who hate Christians. So we're gonna get them and we'll tell them what's what and what they got coming to them or something. The most helpful stance to take with non-Christians is that there are people who are not yet Christians. And the Bible is crammed filled with stories of people who had a very different faith, who even persecuted the church, and then came to a place where today we call them saints, where we need their stories to strengthen our faith and remind how to treat others. And you think of Saul, who became Paul. He was too young to stone Stephen, but he at least got to hold the coats and watch as the first martyr is stoned to death and later goes on to be the fiercest persecutor of the church. And yet Jesus encounters him and everything changes. And then he spends the rest of his life writing Bible and planting churches. And you know, what if we treated every non-Christian as if they just might be Saul? Because you never know what God can do. But the point is that our battle is not against people. Paul talks about it. It's a battle against the spiritual forces of this realm. And I know I've talked about it one way. I don't think I've talked about it the other way, which is if for a moment we could see not just the pews and the people, but if we could see the angels around us and the saints fighting before us, we would probably be much humbler people and take a lot less credit for anything that went good in our lives. But the reverse is also true, that if we could for a moment see the attacks of the enemy all around us, we'd be scared. But scared enough to the point where we'd probably never miss church. We'd probably be here pretty much every day, and Bill and Linda would try to ask you to leave every now and then so they could clean, because we got people stuck in church all the time. Martin Luther said it this way: if you could see how many knives, darts, and arrows of the enemy are every moment aimed at you, you would be glad to come to the sacrament as often as possible. And theologian Mike Breen wrote this: we are at war. and you are going to get really hurt if you are not alert to the wiles of your enemy. He is an absolute jerk and wants to see everything that you hold dear completely and utterly destroyed. He doesn't make truces. He doesn't have a soft spot in his heart. He wants to ravage your life and burn everything to the ground. He wants scorched earth. James 4:7 says, submit to God, resist the enemy, and he will flee from you. Why? Because our strength is not in and of ourselves. Our strength is in God. There's a story, some of you probably kind of know, of Michelangelo's painting of the Sistine Chapel ceiling, where historically church buildings were done very differently than they are today. Since so few people were able to understand what the priest was doing and what people were singing or talking about, the idea was that every square inch of the building would serve a religious teaching point. So stained glass wouldn't be some geometrical shapes and colors. It would be a Bible story. And if there was a wall, you don't just throw paneling or sheetrock. You let the entire place speak for God. So it's either covered in gold or it's the best biblical art the church could muster at the time. And in that keeping, when the Sistine Chapel was being constructed, they wanted to do a fresco on the ceiling. And Michelangelo painted, and a lot of you probably can kind of remember, there's the painting of God reaching out to Adam, right? But the catch is, the story of how that came to be was rooted in an attack of Michelangelo's enemies, where Michelangelo actually didn't do a fresco. Actually, it's plaster that's wet, and as it hardens, the painter paints on it. And the catch is, it can be kind of three-dimensional, but also the color of the paint gets absorbed into the plaster as it dries. So it's a quirky sort of thing to do, I guess. I know I've never done it. But Michelangelo was a sculptor, and he never did frescoes. Raphael did frescoes and was well known for it. And there was a lot of people who were big fans of Raphael and hated Michelangelo. Like, there's good, God-loving people who are big fans of the Packers and really want to see the Cowboys fail, so I hear. And, you know, but there were fans back then, too. And so there are people that are big fans of Raphael and just wanted to see Michelangelo fall on his face. So they went to the Pope and they said, Pope, we hear you're going to get some frescoes done. And the Pope says, yeah, who do you think I should get to do it? And they said, Michelangelo. Let this guy make a total fool of himself, doing something he's never done before, so Raphael can come in and save the day and win all the accolades. But the catch is, what Michelangelo had going for himself, doing something he'd never done, something he wasn't equipped to do, was that he knew he was doing something he'd never done and that he wasn't equipped to do it. And so the first thing he did was to grab as many priests and theologians and pastors as he could find and ask them about the Bible and to teach him, what belongs in a place of worship, and put together this depiction of the book of Genesis on the ceiling, culminating in the north wall. Jesus' words, ask and you shall find, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be opened to you, that verse. And so he's got a theme, and then he hires the best fresco people in the world and surrounds himself with them and learns from them, to the point where eventually he spent 4 years on his back on scaffolding. But the only reason he succeeded with the masterpiece we have today is because he knew he couldn't do it, and that he had no strength or ability in and of himself to defeat his enemies. And so much of life we go through trying to muster the best of what we have, and we just try to do a little bit better. Going to do a little better this year, work a little harder, be a little more faithful, whatever it is. And we still fall on our face. The nicest thing about the armor of God is that it's not our armor. It's not even armor he gives us to use. It's his armor. And he gets all the accolades when things go well. And the battle belongs to the Lord. This is a battle that's already won. This is when the war is already finished off, but they send some soldiers over to clean up the remains. There's a lot going on in the world today, and there's a lot of obstacles and challenges. A pastor was recently speaking at a church, and he was talking about sin or something, and somebody said, "Well, no, I don't believe that. I believe that, you know, the world is a good place and people are generally good." And the person snapped back and said, "You've never been to a middle school." which is just, I mean, there's hard things and there's struggles, but we're not fighting people. We're fighting an enemy of another realm. But the battle's already been won. And so we just get to celebrate that and walk in faith.